Please just start by telling us a little bit about yourself and about your work.
Okay. Well, the quick and dirty version is my background is public policy. I have a master's degree in public policy from Georgetown, which I used to go to work immediately on Capitol Hill as a legislative assistant to Congressman John Conyers, Jr., focusing really on domestic economic and social policy issues. But it was while doing that work, I was putting together work on a new community development grant, actually, for Detroit, our constituents, when a colleague said to me that there was a new international investment agreement being negotiated called the Multilateral Agreement on Investment that would essentially invalidate our ability to do this work at the local level. And I had never heard of this agreement. I investigated further, and essentially the more I looked into it, the more I learned that international trade and investment agreements like the Multilateral Agreement on Investment were in fact being designed to trump existing domestic legislation and to open gates to corporate access and limit government work on behalf of people and communities, and turned my organizing and policy attention to that area, and have been doing that ever since, and actually was part of a movement that defeated that agreement, the MAI, and then turned its attention to institutions like the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and that is what I have been doing ever since. In following that process, I quickly turned my attention after September 11th to the Bush administration's focus on using the excuse of fighting terrorism to advance its existing free trade, corporate globalization agenda, which then aggressively was applied with the war on Iraq. And my focus has been, in respect to the war on Iraq, the economic invasion of Iraq, the U.S. corporations involved in that, but more importantly, Bush administration economic policy toward Iraq that amounts to as much of a devastating invasion as the military invasion, and that pretty much brings us up to date with where I am now and what my work is right now.
Well, you've had speaking engagements on Democracy Now! You're right now in Indianapolis, Indiana, headed to Philly, and next Saturday, September 24th, you're going to be here in Olympia. Can you tell us why you're out on tour and how you're being received?
You know, I speak anywhere and everywhere I can, particularly when it comes to the war, and I take every invitation I can and every opportunity I can. This event in Indianapolis, actually it was in Bloomington at Indiana University, was a part of a very interesting event. For those of you who aren't aware, I certainly wasn't. Today is National Constitution Day, on which we are supposed to observe the U.S. Constitution, and all federally funded U.S. institutions like universities are supposed to celebrate the Constitution on this day. And I was a highly controversial addition to a panel of very prestigious lawyers, of which I am prestigious but not a lawyer, challenging the role of the U.S. Constitution. The framework for the event was, is the U.S. Constitution a model for other governments? And what I was arguing was that while that may be possible, what the U.S. government has historically done is not, in fact, try to force its own constitution on other countries, but rather try and force its own economic and political agenda on other countries in the framing of constitutions, and the experience in Iraq being the perfect case study of the U.S. government aggressively working to frame a constitution in Iraq that would service U.S. economic and political goals rather than any, any goals that were actually in tune with those for the people of Iraq. And this is a part of a number of speaking events that I'm going to continue doing, and particularly do many more when the book is out. And generally, it's very well received. There are definitely people who do not agree with me politically, who support the war, but fewer and fewer. You know, even in a state like Indiana, people are, I think, even if they supported the war, have a lot of very big questions and are very open to hearing alternative analysis, even if they're not necessarily ready to jump on board. And I did end my presentation today with a reminder that September 24th is the National Day of Action Against the War, and encouraging people to partake in that. You know, even if a lot of people didn't jump up to join me for September 24th, they certainly listened and are increasingly listening, I think, more intently, and hearing explanations about, you know, things that we've been saying all along, of course, the role of oil, the intent of gaining access to Iraq's oil, the role of corporate greed and political expansion of the Bush administration. And it's been very heartening to see how I've been accepted by audiences, even as I said, when the organizers of the event itself were heavily challenged about my participation in the panel.
Well, I'm really glad, and all of us are honored that you're going to be here in Olympia with us on Saturday, September 24th. That's 7 o'clock at the Capitol Theater, and you can get reserved seating there, $10 at Traditions or Rainy Day. And could you maybe just quickly say what folks should expect and why they should come out and hear you talk?
Well, there's a lot of wonderful things to expect. There's going to be a number of local activists and organizations that are going to be speaking about local efforts. I think probably one of the most important reasons to come out, even before talking about what I'm going to be speaking about, is that we are at such an important moment right now in this country with the mood of the United States against the Bush administration and against the war in Iraq, and that this is the culmination of all of our organizing. For everyone who has felt depressed after marching on February 15th and the war still happened, working to, you know, if not elect Kerry, to not see Bush be reelected and to see him still be reelected, and when people are feeling frustrated, the culmination of all of that activity has been this groundswell that we are now experiencing, in which Cindy Sheehan was able to find such tremendous support in the United States, where returning Iraqi soldiers, U.S. soldiers who fought in Iraq, are able to find tremendous support from the anti-war community and to be leaders of the anti-war movement in the United States in unprecedented levels in comparison to, say, Vietnam, where the majority of the American public now opposes the war, the majority of the American public now is unsatisfied with the Bush presidency. Even Republicans are distancing themselves from Bush and his position on the war. That it now is really the turning point when we can take that energy and that momentum and say, not only do we need to leave Iraq, but we have specific policy alternatives about how to make this a graceful exit and to leave Iraq at least not worse than when we found it, or at least not worse than it currently is. And the analysis that I will present is about, you know, the economic policies that the Bush administration had laid out, you know, at a minimum. You know, we can go back many, many years to talk about what ultimately became the Bush administration policy in Iraq, but focusing in on this invasion, at least 2 months before the invasion of Iraq, the Bush administration had an economic policy framework for what it wanted to implement in the country. That economic policy framework was put in place by Paul Bremer and the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. And those economic policies still exist today and have only really been advanced by the constitution discussions and the existing draft constitution for Iraq. And what those policies do is guarantee U.S. Foreign corporate access to Iraq's oil sector, foreign corporate access to the entire Iraqi market, and that financial and also obviously political control, because if U.S. companies control Iraq's oil, they certainly control the heart and soul of Iraq's financial future, those policies are destined to remain locked in place if the only thing that the anti-war movement focuses on is the soldiers. And of course we should focus on ending the occupation of Iraq, but that's only part of the picture. And that, you know, what I'm going to do is present the larger picture of how U.S. corporations are making billions and continue to make billions in Iraq, how they hope to make significantly more, how they hope to keep their hands locked on Iraq's oil even without the U.S. occupation, but of course, more importantly, you know, what we can do and are doing to stop that, and why September 24th is such an important day to come together and talk about those ideas, but really to refuel ourselves and get ready for this next very important stage of the anti-war movement.
Well, and the proceeds for the benefit on Saturday will go to benefit Cindy Sheehan and the Gold Star Families for Peace. That's www.gsfp.org. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about the sense of economic invasion of Iraq. Perhaps you can talk about how that's also been working in Afghanistan, as well as how we are seeing it begin to work in New Orleans, how this is a kind of ready-made policy that is kind of what Jordan Flaherty called the disaster industrial project.
Disaster industrial complex.
Thank you.
I think, you know, the instances are very different, but it's interesting to see how similar they are. I mean, what I would say, broadly speaking, first, is that what the Bush administration has done is very aggressively apply an ethos, which is that private companies should do everything, and that private companies should get lots of money from the federal government, a huge transfer of wealth from the federal government to private corporations, many of them, you know, so intimately connected to the Bush administration that there's, you know, a revolving door would be, you basically eliminate the door, forget make it revolving, just eliminate the barrier between the two. Halliburton being the most obvious example, but not even the most blatant. Companies like Lockheed Martin, Chevron, Texaco, even Bechtel, Shaw, Fluor, all of these companies that are receiving enormous billions upon billions of dollars of contracts, intimately entwined with the administration. The Bush administration has successfully set up this model where it simply hands as much as it possibly can over to the private sector with as limited government regulation as possible. In Iraq, it was able to do that by changing Iraq's laws and specifically implementing a policy that said that it was illegal for the Iraqi government to preference Iraqis in the reconstruction effort, which meant that, you know, currently 150 U.S. corporations have contracts with the U.S. government for work in Iraq, totaling more than $50 billion. Halliburton way in the lead at $11 billion, but followed by Fluor and Shaw and Bechtel with totals in the $8 billion, $7 billion, $3 billion. A lot of companies making a lot of money. Those same companies are getting these immediate short-term contracts for the Katrina disaster and the cleanup effort. And the reason why Halliburton was so quick is because it's under the same Pentagon contract in which basically Halliburton is the company that gets to do all of the work that the U.S. military and the Army Corps of Engineers used to do much cheaper and used to be the ones who would automatically be deployed and had the service capability. That's all been privatized, essentially, to Halliburton. And they have contracts that do not need to be competitively bid, that have cost-plus, which means a guaranteed coverage of their costs, regardless to an extent of how high the costs go, with a guaranteed profit margin built in. And that's why Halliburton was immediately put on board after Katrina. But Bechtel is there, and all the same other companies are there as well. And in Afghanistan, it's been a very different picture because there is less political interest. Well, let me rephrase this. There's less money to be made in Afghanistan. That's because Afghanistan ultimately has less resources. And so there's much less interest from U.S. corporations to get involved in Afghanistan because it's a very poor country. It has very few resources. That, of course, is not the case for Iraq. And, you know, with the U.S. government footing the entire bill for Katrina is not the case, sadly, on the Gulf Coast. And we're just seeing, you know, a huge looting of the federal budget and adding to the federal deficit, of course, through this disaster capital arrangement that the Bush administration has done such a good job of putting in place.
Well, another example that seems to come up that you've done in your work is around the privatization of water as well. Mm-hmm. And having worked for John Conyers, I'm sure you're real familiar with those efforts in Detroit and Highland Park. Can you talk about some of the parallels and some of the examples that come up when we talk about the privatization of water?
Well, you know, I'm gonna stick on the topic of Iraq. One of the very interesting debates that has emerged just in the past couple of days with the turning over of the draft constitution from Iraq to the United Nations is a new dispute that has emerged over water. And, you know, for your listeners that aren't aware, you know, many people talk now about water, what oil was to the last century, water will be to this century, the resource over which supply is significantly dropping, demand is rising, and where some people see a human environmental tragedy on the verge of taking place unless we do something, others see a tremendous economic opportunity. And the more that private companies can get their hands on water, the more money can be made. And it is a resource over which wars have been fought and will continually and increasingly be fought. Iraq has the world's second largest supply of oil, but it has one of the largest supplies of water in the Middle East, being at the center of the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, having an extensive water system. There are now discussions over the importation and exportation of water from Iraq and who will have control of that resource. Right now, the Bechtel Corporation, which is one of the largest water privatization companies in the world, has the reconstruction contract that includes rebuilding Iraq's water systems. There is the possibility that could translate if one of Paul Bremer's orders that he put in place in Iraq is a privatization order, calling for but not yet implementing the privatization of all of Iraq's publicly owned businesses. If Iraq's water is privatized, there is a strong likelihood that Bechtel could be right in line to do that privatization. And what has happened the world over, and Bechtel is a perfect example, is that when water is privatized, it becomes a resource on which a profit has to be made. The best way for a company to make profit is to cut costs and raise prices. They do that by cutting access, cutting the benefits to workers, and by raising prices on the population. And poor populations around the world have suddenly been faced with skyrocketing prices for life's most vital resource, water. One thing that has been interesting is that in the United States, where there has been a slight move towards water privatization, there's been an equally strong fight back among communities where privatization has taken place, saying, you know, this is not acceptable in the United States. The government provides water and it's subsidized, and it's only in other countries where we've been holding the government's feet to the fire to make them continue with privatization. Where we are not, you know, we are fighting it here and fighting it very successfully.
Well, I guess one of the things that I'm trying to get into is the way that this neoliberalism, this set of policies around privatization, around a so-called personal responsibility, around deregulation, are kind of spiraling into the lives of folks all around the world as a kind of capitalist globalization, or what used to be and perhaps should be called imperialism. And I'm trying to understand how this is working both in Iraq, here in Africa, and around the world.
Well, you know, part of the intent of my book, I mean, you can tell by the title, the Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time, is that I am trying to explain that similar phenomenon. Basically, to understand this, you know, as a historical phenomenon, as you say, imperialism, colonialism, corporate globalization is another manifestation of this very historic trend. And the Bush administration is unique only in that it has very specific designs on empire. It has a very specific image of itself as needing to change policies through whatever means necessary, including military invasion, to ensure that the United States has all of the resources that it thinks it needs, that its companies are able to expand as freely as possible, and that the United States will be everyone's guarantor of supposedly guarantor of peace, if only it can acquire all of the means to control as much as possible as of the world as it can, specifically in terms of resources and political agendas. And the mechanisms in the past that have been applied to change these policies have been institutions like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and these institutions have used corporate globalization policy to change laws all around the world, including the United States. The World Trade Organization, of course, has forced the United States to change its laws and weaken its government regulations. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have done this all over the world at the bidding of the United States. The Bush administration is unique in that it feels the ability to make these same demands in a unilateral fashion, and the ability to back up those demands with military intervention without any sort of need to hide its agenda. It's pretty straightforward about its agenda. And it is unique in that degree, and is unique in its callousness, I think, to a large extent. And it has also, in response, I think, created it has created its own enemy, in that the Bush administration has created the largest backlash against the United States, bad feeling towards the United States, bad actions towards the United States, and increases in terrorism against the United States because of this callousness. And I think if there's any proof that the Bush administration is unique in its policies, it is the unique hatred that those policies have engendered and the unique violent opposition that they have engendered, I think stands as the example. But it is, as you suggest, sort of long time coming of reactions to policies that have been devastating countries around the world, finally coming home to roost with a government that just says, yes, this is the way it is and this is the way it will be, and what's good for the United States is what's good for the world.
Well, with very few exceptions, I mean, some of them being Barbara Lee and Maxine Waters and, of course, John Conyers, there's been very little opposition from the Democrats to this Bush agenda. And one of the debates over the last few years has been, well, what is the Democratic Party today if they're certainly just kind of riding, they're not leading this agenda, they're certainly not resisting it and are kind of along for the ride. Can you talk about where we're at in terms of the opposition in this country and where it's principally coming from?
Well, that's a good question. The Democrats have just done a very, very sad, non-existent job of taking on the Bush administration when it has come to the war. There are some 50 members of the Democratic Party who have finally signed on to, I believe it's a resolution that's circulating in the House right now, calling for the immediate withdrawal of troops, and 50 is a good number. It's more than just the handful that had been speaking out. Obviously, the number of both Democrats and now even Republicans calling for a timetable has significantly increased, and again, that's because of our pressure. So I think, it eventually trickles up to the Congress. But what the real opposition in the United States is coming from the soldiers, the families, the humanitarians among us who know that this is wrong and continue to organize every day to stop the war. And that trickles up. I think that that influence is felt. Cindy Sheehan didn't just pop out of nowhere and suddenly create a worldwide phenomena. She has been part of the anti-war movement from the beginning. She is intimately connected with the anti-war movement. She received tremendous support from the anti-war movement in everything from, literally the infrastructure of Camp Casey to the media to, everything that she's done, financial support from people all around the country. That is the anti-war movement, which is forcing policymakers to finally take a position. Now, one of the things that we can do, however, and my friend David Solnit has done tremendous work in this area, is stop the war without necessarily, depending on our policymakers, and I do not advocate giving up on them, that there are many things that we can continue to do, which can, I believe, stop the war, even without their help. One is counter-recruitment efforts and support for returning soldiers who oppose the war and helping soldiers take a stand not to fight. That is an extensive area of work that people are doing all across the country, which essentially drains the military out of the military. If there's no one to lead the occupation, then you can't have an occupation. The second is identifying the corporations that are profiting and making it impossible for them to profit from the war, making it so that their our consumer boycotts, our shame campaigns, where it's made more and more known to their shareholders and their customers that these are companies that are doing war profiteering, and that is working. And finally, there is the alternative media, which you are a part of, which is raising the awareness of the public so that we can increase these numbers from beyond the majority of the population opposing the war to 60% opposing the war to 75% opposing the war, making it impossible for our leaders politically to, quote-unquote leaders, to maintain a position in support of the war and imagine that they're going to be reelected in the next election. And I think all of these processes are happening all across the country, and they are leading to our elected officials finally taking notice, but we are not dependent on that happening to see this war brought to an end.
Antonia, if you have just a couple more minutes, I have a few more questions.
Sure.
Can you maybe get into some of your work in counter-recruitment, some of the things that it involves, and even some of the success stories that you've been a part of in terms of counter-recruitment?
I have not been doing counter-recruitment work myself. I can talk about the work that others have done. I'm going to be participating in a protest on Friday the 23rd before I hop on a plane to go to Olympia for the presentation on the 24th, which is the work that has been done, and there's a number of groups across the country doing it, and I think there's an organization called the Ruckus Society that would be a good website for people to go to find out more about counter-recruitment efforts, and it's ruckus.org. Where groups have been doing things such as working with high schools and universities to stop the omnipresent presence of recruiters from being allowed to recruit in their campuses, to city ballot measures attempting to achieve the same goal, to letting parents know that their children are being put on lists for recruiters to get information on unless they specifically opt off of the list. Most importantly, supporting the voices of returning soldiers who oppose the war, who have gone and given presentations across the country in the populations that are being targeted by recruiters, which is largely Hispanic communities have become the prime target, and the actual target audience has been not the youths themselves, but the parents. The new tactic for the Pentagon is to say that to parents, if you want your kids to succeed in life, they need to join the military. And that's the new multi-billion-dollar advertising campaign that the Pentagon has come up with. And having returning soldiers talk to parents, talk to youth, talk to people explaining what the war is really about and their opposition to it. And also just, you know, the straightforward going to recruiting offices and, you know, sitting down and letting recruiters know that there's opposition to the recruitment and letting people who are considering being recruited know that they have support in their choice not to do so. But one of the other really interesting work has been counter-recruitment job fairs, which have been set up to say, you know, we know you're thinking of joining the military because of economic need. Well, here are other things you can do instead. And that's been a really interesting method as well.
Well, we've been talking briefly, well, earlier, and I feel like I'm jumping around, and I apologize for that, but I'm trying to get this in things specifically on Iraq and how Iraq fits into that larger context of the invading one nation, one economy at a time. And before we talk briefly about the policies of neoliberalism and those policy implementation via WTO,